Disc 41.
With the raising of the jury issue, the civil rights battle at once became even more complicated. A tangle now not only of legal and parliamentary complications, but of moral complications as well. No longer was all the right clearly on the side of the liberals. Even Hubert Humphrey, who was to stand fast against the amendment because you could not really rely on Southern juries to be fair, was to confess that his emotions were mixed, really. This was a terribly difficult issue for me because my populist background had always emphasized the importance of jury trial. My father talked to me about things like that. With the raising of the jury issue, both sides held some moral high ground, and since granting one right, the right to a jury trial, would nullify the other right, the right to vote, there seemed to be no basis for compromise between them. And if the South, with the West on its side, would not have to stand alone in the fight to come, neither would the liberals. The GOP was standing by their side. On Part 4, unlike on Part 3, Brownell had his boss's support. The elimination of Part 3 narrowed the scope of the administration's bill to the one area, voting, for which Dwight Eisenhower's support was unequivocal, and the president understood that the amendment would, as Brownell put it, practically nullify any voting rights provision. Placing a jury trial between a court order and the enforcement of that order would mean that we are really welcoming anarchy, Eisenhower told a press conference. With the president behind him, Noland was taking the step, rare with Republicans, of making the vote on O'Mahony's amendment a party policy position, and Noland's efforts were being supplemented now by a politician much more wily and far tougher than he. Recognizing the magnitude of the stakes involved in the struggle for civil rights legislation, and recognizing as well the caliber of his main adversary, Richard Nixon had decided to engage him hand to hand. He had begun spending long hours in the vice president's office off the Senate lobby. Visiting him there, Stuart Alsop found him, as he reported to Johnson through George Reedy, full of admiration for the job you have done. On Nixon's desk, Alsop told Reedy, was a list of 9 Republicans that are going to be worked on. One of them is Gordon Allott, but Alsop did not see the other names. It is Nixon, maneuvering quietly and deftly in the background, who is spearheading the bipartisan no-compromise bloc that is adamantly against writing a jury trial amendment into the bill, Robert S. Allen reported. He is working closely, not only with Noland, but with such Democratic militants as Douglas, Humphrey, and McNamara. Noland may not have been able to count votes, but Nixon could, and he was counting more than enough. After talking with the vice president, Allen told his readers that defeat is in store for the amendment. Conservative columnists agreed. Many Republican senators had been willing to support amendments against Section 3, but they are not expected to go along with the jury trial amendment, Gould Lincoln reported. As soon as Part 3 was removed on July 24th, Noland announced that he would press for an early vote, during the very next week, in fact, on Part 4, and predicted that an overwhelming majority of the GOP senators would vote against the amendment. Defeat did indeed appear to be in store for the South on the vote, which of course meant that the South would not allow a vote, that it would launch a filibuster that would mean defeat for civil rights and for Lyndon Johnson. The chasm between the two sides seemed unbridgeable. Every so often the play of history turns up an issue so full of personal and regional conflict, so grounded in moral philosophy and so subject to the clash of ancient but contending principles, that it stands apart from all the normal preoccupations of political life, James Reston wrote. Such an issue is now before the Senate. At this point, George Reedy writes, Johnson rose to what I will always regard as his greatest height. He was absolutely determined that there would be a bill. Against all reason, Johnson kept insisting that a compromise must exist somewhere. Most observers thought that the two poles were too far apart to find a middle ground. But using the same set of facts, LBJ insisted that the reality was the other way around. That if two opposing sides had a degree of validity in their contentions, there simply had to be a legitimate way of meeting them both. If there was a way, Lyndon Johnson was going to find it. He pleaded and threatened and stormed and cajoled, Reedy recalls, He prowled the corridors of the Senate, grabbing senators and staff members indiscriminately, probing them for some sign of amenability to compromise. He had begun while the Part III fight had still been going on. Trying to find a middle ground, some form of jury trial amendment acceptable to both liberals and the South, he had spent hours on the phone in nonstop conversations with the most ingenious legal minds he knew, pleading with Corcoran, Roe, Clifford, Fortas, Acheson, and a dozen other lawyers for something to break the logjam. He had had Tommy Corcoran assemble a group of lawyers, a dozen leading legal minds of the new and fair deals, in the conference room at Corcoran and Roe, and Corcoran had told them how important it was that a solution be found. "You know, we're all pros here, and we can talk to each other. We know we're here to elect Lyndon Johnson president. Who's kidding whom, and let's get going." Dean Acheson put several bright associates at his law firm, Covington and Burling, to work on the problem. Senators were flooding the Democratic Policy Committee with amendments and suggestions for amendments. O'Mahony edited and re-edited the version he had introduced. Where they were run by the committee's lawyers, Siegel and the brilliant Solis Horwitz. "We drafted 25 or 30 different versions," Horwitz was to recall. "We were constantly trying to satisfy both sides." The search grew desperate. O'Mahony kept introducing these various amendments one right after the other. It got ridiculous. Each suggestion proved to have a fatal weakness. Some foundered on conflicts with other statutes already on the books, others on either the rock or the hard place. Every amendment that would add to the Civil Rights Bill a provision that required jury trials, in no matter what form, was totally unacceptable to liberals. Every amendment that did not include an absolute guarantee of jury trials was totally unacceptable to Russell and the South. For some time, Reedy says, every effort turned out to be a false start. And time was running out. And now, with Part III disposed of, it was running out fast, thanks to Nolan's stubbornness. Confident that he would win a vote on Part IV, the leader of the bipartisan Civil Rights Coalition was pushing for one more and more insistently, repeatedly announcing that he was prepared to move for an immediate vote. If that motion came to the floor without a compromise already in place, the Civil Rights Bill, bipartisan coalition or not, would be dead. At the close of a Senate session one evening in July, however, while the fight and the focus were still on Part III, Lyndon Johnson had returned to his office and reached for Walter Jenkins's yellow legal pad with the list of persons who had telephoned during the day. And Jenkins had silently pointed to a name on the pad. And Johnson, before he turned to the rest of his messages, told Jenkins, "Get me Ben Cohen." By the 1950s, the name of Benjamin V. Cohen had faded in Washington's memory, in part because it had been a long time since he and another young bill drafter, Tommy Corcoran, working closely with Sam Rayburn, had drafted the Securities Exchange Act and the Public Utilities Act, and other keystones of the Great New Deal arch. In part because while the accordion-playing, storytelling, relentlessly self-promoting Corcoran had made himself a flamboyant figure in the Capitol, head of one of Washington's most influential political law firms, the shy and dreamy Cohen, who looked and talked, as a friend wrote, like a Dickens portrait of an absent-minded professor, had withdrawn from the Washington social scene to spend more and more time alone in his book-cluttered DuPont Circle apartment. In the days since they had been part of the same little group of New Dealers, see Volume 1, The Path to Power, pages 450 to 453, Lyndon Johnson had seen less and less of Ben Cohen. "You had to be very patient with him," Gerald Siegel was to explain, and Johnson was an impatient man. But decades before, men who knew Corcoran and Cohen well had learned that despite his charm and gift for the blarney, Corcoran's mind, canny and politically astute though it was not the equal of his silent partner's. A remark of Sam Rayburn's still circulated among men on Capitol Hill who had been there during the early days of the New Deal. After one meeting at which Corcoran did almost all the talking, Rayburn confided to a friend, "Cohen's the brains." Cohen had been among the lawyers whom Johnson had telephoned to ask for suggestions about the jury trial amendment. And now, on that July evening when Johnson returned his call, Cohen said he had a suggestion to make, and Johnson asked him to come to lunch. and as Gerald Siegel said, reminiscing years later, everyone came up with a different plan, and all of them were worth nothing, except one man, Ben Cohen. Cohen was to recall, after the author, during an interview in 1976, had finally persuaded him to talk about the 1957 episode, that he had been working on the problem of reconciling the right to trial by jury with enforceable civil rights legislation when his attention had been caught by an article that had appeared in the April 29th issue of a journal of liberal opinion, The New Leader. The article, by a University of Wisconsin law professor, Carl A. Auerbach, addressed that problem and had a solution for it. It was not necessary to rely only on jury trials to enforce civil rights, Professor Auerbach had written, because jury trials are required only in criminal contempt proceedings. They are not required in civil contempt proceedings, and civil contempt proceedings could also be employed to enforce civil rights. In criminal contempt, Auerbach said, the judge is punishing a defendant for violating, disobeying, a judge's specific injunction or order. In civil contempt, Auerbach said, the aim is different. Not to punish a defendant for having violated a court order, but to force the defendant to obey the order in the future. If the court's order is disobeyed, the judge will hold the violator of his injunction in contempt of court and have him imprisoned until he does obey. As soon as he does, he will be freed. He can open his prison door and walk out any time he pleases by obeying the court's order. And therefore, jury trials were not required. The impasse over the 1957 Civil Rights Bill, Auerbach wrote, had come about because the bill contemplated only criminal contempt proceedings. If a provision for civil contempt was added, the impasse would be broken. If the United States proceeds against an alleged violator of a civil rights injunction in order to punish him for criminal contempt, all the protections accorded the accused in a criminal trial should be extended, including a jury trial, he said. But the United States should also be authorized to bring civil contempt actions against alleged violators of civil rights injunctions. Its objective would be purely remedial, not to punish the violators for their past disobedience, but to coerce future obedience to the court decree. If the decree, for example, ordered the registration of Negro voters, the local officials refusing to do so could be imprisoned until they obeyed the order. If they did so, they would be released. There would therefore be no need for a jury trial. Auerbach's solution would require merely the addition to O'Mahony's amendment of a new paragraph, one authorizing the use of civil as well as criminal contempt, Cohen explained. But, he explained, that new paragraph might help create the necessary new ground, the new ground that could become the middle ground, the common ground, for a compromise that would enable the Civil Rights Bill to pass. While Southern senators would still be able to tell their constituents that the bill, by including a jury trial amendment, guaranteed Southerners trials by Southern juries and was therefore so weak as to be meaningless, Northern senators, on the other hand, would now know that, despite that guarantee, the bill contained strong enforcement provisions unvitiated by any provision for trial by Southern juries. 20 years before, Cohen told the author, he had considered young Representative Johnson promising material. Subsequently, he said, he had been somewhat put off by the intensity of Johnson's ambition. But now, in 1957, talking to Johnson over lunch, he felt that the promise had been fulfilled. He was a man with a mission, to pass a civil rights bill, who grasped with impressive speed the significance of the Auerbach article. He asked Senator O'Mahony to see me, Cohen recalled, and together, along with Siegel, by July 17th, they had worked out the wording of the necessary new paragraph. Ben was simply my closest advisor, Siegel says. There were seemingly insuperable problems to arriving at a wording that would be accepted by all sides, but every time there was a problem, Ben solved it. O'Mahony's amendment guaranteed jury trials in civil rights criminal contempt proceedings. The new paragraph said that that guarantee shall not be construed to deprive courts of their power by civil contempt proceedings, without a jury, to secure compliance with any lawful writ, process, order, rule, decree, or command of the court, including the power of detention. On that date, while the fight over Part 3 was still being waged, O'Mahony had sent the revised amendment to the desk. And now, on July 24th, as soon as the 52-38 vote on Part 3 was announced, it became the Senate's pending business. The new version of the O'Mahony amendment allowed Lyndon Johnson to add additional numbers, representing new votes for the amendment, on the left or yea side of the names on his long tally sheet, but only a few more numbers. They were next to the names of Hell's Canyon Westerners who had wanted to help the South but had been shying from doing so because the amendment would have made the whole civil rights bill too blatantly meaningless. Their tentative commitment was now solidified. Even if every one of the 22 Southerners and 12 Hell's Canyon Democrats voted for the amendment, however, that would be a total of only 34 votes, whereas 48 were required for passage. There were still no numbers, or almost none, in that left-hand yea column next to the names of the 46 Republicans and about 15 non-Southern and non-Hell's Canyon Democrats who made up the bulk of the Civil Rights Coalition, a solid majority against the amendment. The odds against passage of the Civil Rights Bill were still very long. The South was willing, to avoid being forced to filibuster and also to help Lyndon Johnson become president, to accept a weak bill, and since the amendment's new version still contained a jury trial guarantee, it was still weak enough for the South to accept it. Republicans and liberals, however, still would not accept it. While the new version gave them part of what they wanted, a means of allowing judges to jail civil rights violators without a jury trial, it still ensured that Southerners would not be jailed for criminal contempt, and it was therefore still too weak to be acceptable. Since, with a solid majority, they could pass the bill unweakened, without any jury trial amendment at all, they felt they had no reason to accept one. They would vote against and defeat the amendment. The South would then filibuster and thereby defeat the bill. To pass the amendment, and thus the bill, Lyndon Johnson still needed perhaps 14 Republican and liberal votes. The main advantage of the O'Mahony amendment was not that it in itself got Johnson the votes he needed, it didn't, but that it provided a base from which to fight for those votes. While before the new version, no ground for a compromise had existed, there was new ground now, ground too narrow, but nonetheless more than had existed before. He set out to broaden that ground. With the Senate's attention now focused on Part 4, the hailstorm of proposed changes in the jury trial amendment pouring into G-14 increased in intensity, and Johnson read every one that Siegel or Horwitz thought might be a possibility, and as he read each proposed change, he asked the same question: if I take this one, how many votes will it get me? And suddenly, out of that storm of proposals, there was one, no one remembers who made it, that he felt might get him quite a few votes. This proposal would create more new ground. Since the Civil Rights Bill was going to deal with jury trials, the proposal went, maybe this bill was the place to remedy an injustice that had been perpetrated against labor unions in 1948, when the Taft-Hartley Act had limited strikers' right to jury trials in contempt cases arising out of labor disputes. Unions had attempted repeatedly to have the right restored, but without success. Perhaps, the proposal went, it could be restored in the Civil Rights Act. This suggestion, about labor disputes, not civil rights, was new ground indeed. But Johnson saw how it could win him some new votes for the amendment from liberal senators, not the most ardent civil writers, but liberals with more moderate civil rights views. The opposition of these senators to any jury trial amendment was intensified by their fear of the reaction of their pro-civil rights constituencies if they supported an amendment that weakened the Civil Rights Bill. But a key element of their constituencies was organized labor. Big unions, such as Walter Reuther's UAW and Jim Carrey's Electrical Workers, and the dominant national labor organization, the AFL-CIO, were ardent supporters of civil rights and therefore adamant opponents of jury trials. If labor could be persuaded, through the inclusion of this new provision, to look more kindly on the jury trial amendment, it would be much easier for liberal senators to vote for it. New additions to the O'Mahony amendment were hurriedly drafted by Johnson's young bill drafters, and on Friday, July 26th, O'Mahony introduced them. The key provision extended the guarantee of jury trial for criminal contempt beyond civil rights cases, in any proceeding for criminal contempt of any court of the United States, the accused, upon demand therefor, shall be entitled to trial by jury. When O'Mahony rose at his desk in the far corner of the third row and announced that, "I desire to have laid before the Senate a modification of my amendment," Douglas, in the third row, three desks closer to the center, rose to attack this constant rewriting. "Is there to be another edition tomorrow?" he asked. Sitting right in front of Douglas, however, was the more moderate Kefauver. Turning around, he told Douglas that the modification represents a great advance of civil liberties because it will again assure labor unions of their day in court before a jury of their peers. Labor, Kefauver said, should be anxious for the passage of this act with this amendment included. Johnson had some ground to fight on now, and he fought. To keep the two sides negotiating, to keep the 1957 civil rights fight from degenerating into the open hostility and bitterness on the Senate floor in which so many previous civil rights bills had died, he had to persuade them to conduct the debate in an atmosphere of outward friendliness and respect, or at least civility. So for some days after Part 3 had been disposed of, the opening scene of the Senate each noon hour featured the majority leader as Emily Post. In statements written by Reedy and delivered during his opening remarks each day, Johnson encouraged the Senate to mind its manners, saying on one day that the Senate was on trial, that the world was watching it, and that he was confident that the Senate would do itself proud, that his colleagues would continue the debate as reasonable men. On another day, he said he was happy to see that his confidence was justified. "Never before have I seen in the Senate a debate which has contributed so much to understanding. In that sense, I think the debate has been one of the finest the Senate has ever had." Day after day, he reminded his colleagues that they were taking part in an historic debate, repeated his plea that they be fair and open-minded, open to reason and compromise, and praised them for being so reasonable and open-minded thus far, which of course made it harder for them to act otherwise and kept them as much as possible on their best behavior. Often, on Friday of that week, and during the next week, those statements were read to long arcs of almost empty desks, desks that stayed empty all day. In the days following the hectic floor fight on the Anderson-Aiken Amendment, the Senate chamber was a scene, as the New York Times put it, of such calm that at times hardly half a dozen senators were on the floor. Johnson's opening homilies, moreover, were almost his only public utterances on the subject of civil rights. He had again assumed a low profile, and was not often on the Senate floor, spending his time in the Democratic cloakroom, or huddling behind the closed doors of G-18 with George and Solace and Jerry, or with senators in his offices in the Capitol or back in the SOB. But there, in the cloakroom or behind closed doors, he was fighting too, using the gifts he had demonstrated so vividly during his entire life. All his life, he had had what George Brown called a knack for simultaneously convincing people on opposite sides of an issue that he was on their side, and that knack was desperately needed now. He was the only bridge between the two sides, and if he was to keep them negotiating through him, he had to convince each side that it was in its best interest to negotiate through him, that he was trying to obtain for it the best deal that could be obtained, that while it was necessary for him to maintain a veneer of neutrality for the benefit of the outside world, in reality he was on their side, that he believed what they believed, that he was their friend, that he wanted them to win. And never had this knack been more vividly displayed. He did it with the tone of his voice. With Northerners, his Texas twang became harder, more clipped. When he talked to Southerners, the twang softened into a full-fledged Southern drawl. He did it with words. "If we're going to have any civil rights bill at all, we've got to be reasonable about this jury trial amendment," he said to Paul Douglas in the cloakroom one day. 5 minutes later, he was at the opposite end of the cloakroom, telling Irvin to be ready to take up the nigger bill again. "Let's face it, our ass is in a crack. We're going to have to let this nigger bill pass," he told Stennis. With the Southern senators, the key words, in addition to nigger and nigra, were we and us, to emphasize that he was one of them. Keeping the South in line, persuading Thurmond not to march on the White House and Eastland not to give the Judiciary Committee a month-long vacation and Olin Johnston not to deliver his 40-page speech, was, despite all that Richard Russell could do, becoming increasingly difficult. He had to persuade the Southerners to allow some sort of civil rights bill to pass, not to employ the filibuster to kill it, even though their constituents were expecting them to use the filibuster if necessary. To do so, he made things personal. Over and over again, he told the Southerners, "We have to give them something." And he told them as long as they trusted him, the something would be as little as possible. "I'm on your side, not theirs. Be practical. We have to give them something, but we don't have to put teeth in it." He made it political. "You always thought you wouldn't have to worry about Republican opponents. Well, look around you. I look around, and I see the Republicans shaking bushes all over the South. Well, one day they'll shake the right bush and flush out an opponent for you. My ass is on the line, and your ass is on the line, and the Democratic Party's ass is on the line." He tried to make them understand that as long as the bill contained a jury trial amendment, its passage would have minimal political repercussions for them. "You can go back home and say, 'Listen, we couldn't stop them entirely. They just had too many votes, so they rolled over us. But look what we got. We fought and fixed it up so that those damned Yankee carpetbaggers couldn't come back, and also they couldn't brand you a criminal without a jury trial.'" He played on their pride as Southerners. "We've got a chance to show the Yankees that we're not all ignorant redneck racists down here like they'd like to think," he said. He played on their hope that he might become president, and that if he did, that would be a victory for the South, a victory so great that its possibility should overrule all other considerations. He used this feeling. He played on it. This was a deliberate tactic of his, Reedy says. He played on their fears for the South. For the first time, he said, Negroes have a real leader. A religious leader, a nonviolent man of the cloth. You all know what that means, don't you? A colored Baptist preacher? That's one man who controls the colored community. The colored are not going to give up. They're determined. We can't continue to push these things down their throats. They won't sit still any longer. We have to give them something. He told them, if we don't allow progress on this issue, we're going to lose everything. There's going to be cloture. Rule 22 is going to go, and our opportunity to delay or to slow down and to bring some kind of an order to change will be gone. Or, these Negroes, they're getting pretty uppity these days, and that's a problem for us, since they've got something now they've never had before, the political pull to back up their uppityness. Now we've got to do something about this. We've got to give them a little something, just enough to quiet them down, not enough to make a difference. For if we don't move at all, then their allies will line up against us and there'll be no way of stopping them. We'll lose the filibuster and there'll be no way of putting a brake on all kinds of wild legislation. It'll be Reconstruction all over again. And he played on their fears for themselves, an effective tactic, because Matt Neely's death, expected daily, would reduce the number of Democrats in the Senate to 48. There were currently only 46 Republicans, but the Republican governor of West Virginia was expected to name a Republican to Neely's seat, so there would be 47. Joe McCarthy had died in May, and a special election to fill his seat would be held on August 28th between a Democrat, William Proxmire, and a Republican, Walter J. Kohler, a popular former governor. Since no Democrat had won a Senate seat from Wisconsin in 25 years, it was expected that after the special election, the Republicans would have 48 seats. The party count would be tied. A tie would be broken by the vice president. The Republicans were planning to reorganize the Senate as soon as Kohler was sworn in. A confidential memo sent to Lehman in Switzerland by Julius Edelstein reported that Lyndon Johnson has been warning all the Southerners that unless they relaxed a little and let some kind of a civil rights bill go through, they were in danger of losing their chairmanships. He urged them not to filibuster because to filibuster the civil rights bill would ensure a victory for Kohler. With the liberals, not with the most ardent red-hots, for with them there was no hope, but with the rest of the Democratic liberals, the key words were also we and us. He made them feel that they were in a battle, and that in that battle he was on their side. Warning one liberal senator that there must be a liberal sentry on the floor at all times to guard against a sudden southern legislative maneuver, he told them, "They'll get us on the floor if we're not manned on the floor at all times, so we always have to have a man there." He told them, They'll pick our moment of least resistance and move in. He played on their fears, the fear of what Southern power in the committees could do to their vital projects. Once, when Wayne Morse was threatening, in order to bring the South to heel, to block a unanimous consent agreement some Southerners wanted, Johnson told him, "Look, you're going to be in the position of wanting their support in the future. This, the jury trial amendment, isn't that hurtful to your state's interest or to your own convictions. Don't build it up into a blockage." He had to persuade the Northerners to allow some sort of jury trial amendment in the bill, even though such an amendment stripped the bill of its teeth. He tried to make them understand that the important thing was to get some bill, any bill, passed, to show them we can do it. Once we've got the first one passed, we can go back and improve it, and that the only way to get it passed was to vote for the amendment. "Jim Eastland knows we have to have a civil rights bill," he said to them, "but he has to have a jury trial amendment. We've got to give him a jury trial amendment." He tried to make them understand that so long as the bill contained provisions for voting rights, it was still worth passing. "Give them the vote, that's what matters. Then things'll change, you'll see," he said. When Humphrey tried to argue with him, he said, "Yes, yes, Hubert, I want all those other things, buses, restaurants, all of that, but the right to vote with no ifs, ands, or buts, that's the key. When the Negroes get that, they'll have every politician, north and south, east and west, kissing their ass, begging for their support." Keeping the liberals from forcing the issue to a vote was becoming more and more difficult, for, knowing that they had a majority of the Senate on their side, they thought only about the vote, not about the maneuvers that would precede it, and he tried to make them understand. Because of their distrust of him, he often relayed his word through others. In one liberal caucus, Clint Anderson interrupted a barrage of red-hot bravado about their chances of carrying some amendment to tell them their vote count was wrong. "Let me give you some advice," Anderson said. He named five Democratic senators whom the liberals were counting on their side. "You're right in thinking that you're going to need their help," he told them, "but you haven't got it now." And to advise them to stick with a man whose counts were more accurate, particularly since that man was of their party. "I remember that for many years, whenever we tried to do something on civil rights, Bob Taft would go over and whisper to Dick Russell and we'd be licked. So let's follow our own leader and not these recent Republican converts." Once, John Carroll told his administrative assistant Harry Schnibbe, "God damn it, we'll go on the floor with this. McNamara will do this, and Paul will do that, and we'll make an issue of this." Having learned of the liberals' plans, Johnson sent Bobby Baker to intercept Schnibbe on the floor. "Harry, this is a grave mistake. If you do this, Russell will do this, and Ellender will do this. The majority leader has got to cool this down before we can go forward." And sometimes he delivered the warning himself. "Look, if you press too hard, if you insist on perfection, you'll get it, but it won't be passed." Day after day, he was arguing one side of a point with the Southerners and the other side with the liberals, and arguing both sides with equal persuasiveness. At the same time that he was telling the South that he had counted votes and had found that a filibuster couldn't win, he was telling liberals that he had counted votes and had found that they couldn't beat a filibuster. He was playing it out of both sides, Harry McPherson was to recall. He was down in the trenches with guys who were determined not to let the bill pass, and he was doing his damnedest by every conceivable device to bring them around. He warned them, the Southerners, that much worse would come unless they would pass this modest bill. They believed him. He made them think he'd be with them forever. At the same time, McPherson says, he would tell some of the Northerners that if they would only let this modest bill go through, they would get a better bill later. And they believed him. He told Joe Rao, "You can't beat a filibuster," and Rao says he was correct. "We had the majority, but we didn't have two-thirds." His vote-counting ability was needed, too. For if the jury trial amendment came to a vote without the necessary number of yeas and was therefore defeated, the South would not then permit a vote on the overall bill. Lying before him on the desk in his office was a long Senate tally sheet. When he left the office, the sheet was in his breast pocket. In contrast to most of his tally sheets, this one was notably untidy, for so intense was the pressure from both sides that senators were changing their votes and then changing back again. some of them several times. The long, narrow paper was smudged with erasures and covered not only with numbers but with notes he had jotted down to remind him of what might be the best time to approach a particular senator again, or of some new argument that might work with him. In the cloakroom he would, over and over again, pull the tally sheet out of his pocket, put on his eyeglasses, and study it intently, his thumb moving very slowly down the sheet, seeming to pause at every line, making sure that he was certain of every vote, that he wasn't just thinking, that he knew. And what he knew, counting the votes, was that he didn't have enough. Noland, as Doris Fleeson was to write, twice daily assured his Democratic allies he would lose at most 5 or 6 GOP votes. And Johnson knew that for once Noland's error was not on the side of optimism. Johnson needed 48 absolutely sure votes to make passage of the amendment certain. The exact number of votes he was counting at this stage cannot be determined, but it appears to have been no more than 42. To try to get more votes, he used all the weapons at his command, used them with his customary ruthlessness. The ruthlessness was usually cloaked under senatorial courtesy. It took the form of hints rather than threats. But with these men, threats were not needed. Senators understood the nuances of power. They were well aware that the man asking for their help on the civil rights bill had the power to help them, or not help them, on other bills, bills that were vital to them, to help them with committee assignments, or campaign cash, or office space. The Niagara situation was becoming desperate because frost comes early in autumn on the Niagara frontier, and time was running out. The bill authorizing New York State to begin construction of the huge power dam had been passed through Public Works, but it was still stalled on the floor behind the Civil Rights Bill, and Johnson let New York's senators know that it was going to stay stalled until a Civil Rights Bill was passed. Addressing the majority leader, New York's Irving Ives said that the Niagara frontier is without adequate power. Business will have to cease there. Unemployment will increase. There will be a dire situation there in a very short time unless this redevelopment is begun this year. This measure must have the right of way. But the majority leader, standing at his desk, looking across the aisle at Ives and Javits, said that while I shall do what I can to have it brought to a vote in this body as soon as possible, it might not be possible in the immediate future. Thanks to a decision by the Republican leader and the Republican White House, the pending business, he said, was still civil rights. The next voice came from a desk behind him, in the back row of the Democratic side of the aisle. The bill authorizing the Tennessee Valley Authority to issue revenue bonds is of an emergency nature equal to that of the Niagara bill, Albert Gore said. It is urgent that it be considered. I thank the senator from Tennessee, Lyndon Johnson said. I assure him that I shall urge the Senate at the appropriate time to give consideration to the Tennessee Valley Bill, in which he is so deeply interested. But, he said, the appropriate time would be when a majority of the Senate want to proceed to business other than the Civil Rights Bill. So far as the majority leader is concerned, he is prepared to proceed to the consideration of these bills and get the earliest possible decision. But it wasn't up to him, he said, but to the majority of the Senate. Couched, though it was in soft senatorial courtesy, the message was hard and clear. If the South was pushed too hard on the civil rights bill, it would filibuster. And if there were not sufficient votes to get the bill off the floor by imposing cloture on the filibuster, the only way to get it off the floor so that the Senate could move on to other business, such as Niagara and the TVA, would be to withdraw the bill. So the South had better not be pushed too hard. And if the South was insisting on a jury trial amendment, maybe it would be a good idea to give it one. He was working the cloakroom and the corridors now, working them with everything he had. He used his health. He had had his heart attack, he said. He was a sick man, and he knew it. He had no interest in a presidential nomination or even for another term in the Senate. All he wanted to do was what was best for the country. The strain was too much for him, he said. When he went home at night, he couldn't sleep. The doctors kept giving him new pills. They didn't work. He was starting to get chest pains again. I don't want to die right here, he said. I don't want to fall on my face, drop dead right on the floor of the Senate. He couldn't take much more strain. He made you feel that if you wouldn't go along with what he was asking, you might be murdering this man, one senator recalls. He used the liberals' fear of Russell to explain why he couldn't give them more. When a liberal senator had a suggestion, he would reply that he thought it was a good idea, but of course there was no sense pushing it unless Russell approved. "I'll have to run that by Dick," he said. He used the Southerners' fear of the wild men to explain why he couldn't give them more. "Well, you do that, you're going to lose Wayne Morrison them," he said. He used their pride in the Senate. "We've got the world looking at us here. We've got to make the world see that this body works." He used their pride in their party. "You're the party of Lincoln," he reminded one Republican. "That's something to be proud of. You're the image of Lincoln." To Democrats, he said, "Our party's always been the place that you can come to whenever there's injustice. That's what the Democratic Party's for. That's why it was born. That's why it survives. So the poor and the downtrodden and the bended can have a place to turn. And they're turning to us now. We can't let them down. We're down to the nut-cutting now, and we can't let them down." He used his power and his charm. "I can see him now," Bobby Baker says, "grasping hands and poking chests and grabbing lapels, saying to the Southern politicians something like, 'We got a chance to show the way. We got a chance to get the racial monkey off the South's back. We got a chance to show the Yankees that we're good and decent and civilized down here, not a bunch of barefoot tobacco-chewing crazies.'" When he had finished presenting his arguments to a senator, Harry McPherson was to say, he would sink back into the chair, his eyes wide with the injustice of his burdens, the corners of his mouth inviting pity and support. Then he would come back face to face, perhaps sensing that the other wanted to help, and in that event should hear the whole story, all the demands, the pressures, and the threats, as well as the glory and the achievement that awaited reasonable men if they would only compromise, not on the main thing, but just on this part that the other side would never accept as it was. Unless there could be some accommodation, there would be nothing. The haters would take over, the Negroes would lose it all. I need your help. He used his stories and he used his jokes. He used his promises, used his threats, backing senators up against walls or trapping them in their chairs, wrapping an arm around their shoulders and thrusting a finger in their chests, grasping lapels, watching their hands, watching their eyes, listening to what they said or to what they didn't say. The greatest salesman one-on-one who ever lived, trying to make his biggest sale. Never had he tried harder. In the intensity of his effort, he even instituted a new variation on one of his old devices. Lapels had long been for grabbing, but now he used them, or rather the buttonhole in them, for another purpose. Trying to persuade a senator who was resisting persuasion, Lyndon Johnson would stick his long forefinger through the hole in the senator's lapel to prevent him from moving away. "The other day," George Dixon wrote, "I spied Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson holding Senator Estes Kefauver in captive conference. Kefauver couldn't have gotten away without leaving his lapel behind." To every crisis in his life, he had risen with that effort that made men say, "I never knew it was possible for anyone to work that hard." That effort in which days meant nothing, nights meant nothing. Now, in this greatest crisis, Lyndon Johnson, heart attack or no, rose again to that kind of effort. In the early morning hours, the residential districts of Washington and its suburbs were dark and silent. But now, in the night, the silence of a darkened street would be broken by the faint ringing of a telephone in a senator's house. The senator, picking it up, would hear, "This is Lyndon Johnson." The persuasion would begin, and it might go on for quite some time. Finally, the call would be over. The senator would go back to bed, to sleep if he could. And on another street, in another senator's home, the phone would ring. The streets of the Kalorama section of the district were, in the early morning hours, row after row of darkened houses, and of one house, on 30th Place, in which, night after night during these climactic last weeks of July, every night, lights would be on. Try though he did, however, it appeared as July drew to a close that he wasn't going to win. On Friday, July 26th, the lines had stiffened dramatically. That morning, there had been another meeting of the Southern Caucus in Richard Russell's office. Ellender and Byrd in ice cream suits, most of the others in senatorial dark blue despite the heat. And around the huge mahogany table that morning, there weren't many smiles. Emerging from the meeting, Russell was accosted by Bill White of the Times. Russell told him that the caucus had decided to support the jury trial amendment to the end. If the amendment was defeated, Russell said, the Southerners would then fight the complete bill with every resource open to us. In his article the next day, White explained the meaning of Russell's phrases. He meant that if the amendment was defeated, the Southerners would put in the most implacable filibuster of which they were capable. At the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue that Friday morning, Noland and Saltonstall were breakfasting with Dwight Eisenhower. Encircled by reporters as he was leaving the White House, Noland held up a copy of the president's July 17th statement and pointed to a sentence that someone had underlined at that breakfast table. A jury trial should not be interposed in contempt of court cases growing out of violations of court orders. Noland told the reporters that he was authorized to say that that sentence still represented the president's views. Arriving back in the Senate office building, Noland took the statement into a waiting Republican caucus in the Senate caucus room and emerged to say that most of the 18 Republicans who had deserted the administration on Part 3 had returned on Part 4 and had pledged to stand against any jury trial amendment. Pressed for the number of Republican votes that were certain against the amendment, Noland said 39 or 40. Saltonstall said more than 40. Checking with individual senators, reporters felt that these estimates were correct. If the 15 ardently civil rights Democrats stick together, the New York Post observed, their votes plus this GOP strength would be ample to ensure the amendment's defeat. Johnson flew to Texas late that Friday, but during his weekend on the ranch, he received another blow. Proof that he had underestimated the depth of organized labor's commitment to civil rights. He had been hoping that labor would be enticed into support of the amendment by the extension of its jury trial guarantee to unions. But on Saturday, July 27th, labor began to be heard from in the form of a letter to Johnson from James B. Carey, president of the International Union of Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers. The amendment, Carey wrote in a letter read to Johnson by Reedy over the telephone, would prevent effective enforcement of the right to vote. The issue must be faced squarely, Carey said. With respect to voting rights, we can have either the right to vote or trial by jury for contempt. We cannot have both. And, he said, labor will not barter away effective protection of the right of a Negro to register and vote just to obtain gains for itself. Reedy also told Johnson that when the AFL-CIO issued its statement, it would echo Carey's. Reedy's information was to prove reliable. Assailing the iron determination of the Southern bloc in the Senate to resist any civil rights legislation, the Labor Federation would say that it cannot and will not permit itself to support a crippling amendment just because it offers advantages to organized labor. Hubert Humphrey said he had checked with many union leaders and had not found a soul who was buying this stuff. That weekend was filled with the boasts of Johnson's liberal and Republican opponents. Beaming out of the television screens on CBS's Sunday Face the Nation show, Humphrey said that the amendment's supporters haven't got the votes. Announcing that he was going to demand a ballot that very week, Noland said he had the votes, enough to defeat the amendment and pass the bill intact. Not only enough votes, but votes to spare. Journalists agreed. The Republicans have an extraordinary unity on Part 4, Doris Fleeson wrote. Not more than 5 will join the Southern demand for jury trial. There was also a significant statement that weekend from Richard Russell. Catching him in the Senate dining room on Saturday, the AP's John Chadwick asked him if he would be willing to vote on the amendment during the next week. "I can't say that I am," Russell replied. Having come to the same conclusion as Noland, that the South did not have enough allies to pass the amendment and would lose the vote, the South was going to extend debate so that there would be no vote. The only news Johnson received that weekend was bad news. He had waged a spectacular fight, but he was going to lose. All his work, it seemed, had been for nothing. On Monday and Tuesday, or at least most of Tuesday, developments on the Senate floor appeared to confirm that appraisal. Monday, when Johnson returned from Texas, was bad, with Carey's letter being read into the record by Joe Clark, who used the occasion to jeer at Johnson's attempt to get labor support. I hope that in due course the majority leader will feel free to reveal to the Senate who are the labor leaders who favor a jury trial amendment. With Javits holding the floor for hours, further antagonizing Southerners by his manner, and with increasingly bitter squabbling between liberals and Southerners, Noland could not contain his gloating. In Robert Mann's words, he taunted the Southerners to begin their filibuster. "Let's have it now and fight it out," he said. Tuesday, for most of the day at least, was worse. The day began for Johnson when, still in bed that morning, he was leafing through the Washington Post and came upon a large advertisement. It was an open letter to the Senate of the United States, but it might have been addressed to him personally, so directly did it attack what he had been doing. It would be better not to pass any civil rights legislation at all than to pass this bill. We are in a better position to get justice in civil rights cases under existing laws than we would be if you passed the proposed jury trial amendment. The letter was signed by 81 Southern liberal leaders, including Aubrey Williams, Johnson's one-time boss at the National Youth Administration, and for two decades one of his staunchest supporters. When he reached his office in the Capitol, the day got even worse, for Reedy handed him the AFL-CIO statement, and just as he walked down the stairs and out onto the Senate floor, his attempt to tamp down the outright antagonism between the South and the liberals that would destroy any hopes of compromise appeared to explode. The explosion may have occurred partly because that morning two officers of the Tuskegee Civic Association appeared in the Senate office building to describe the ongoing voting dispute in Alabama's Macon County. They did it at a news conference called by the All-Out Civil Rights Forces. The conference had been designed to attract publicity, and in that aim it failed. Coverage the next day would be scant. The New York Times didn't carry a word. But while reporters didn't come to the conference, senators did. 11 of them, including Paul Douglas and 10 members of the Douglas Group, Republicans as well as Democrats. And they heard for themselves as the two Alabamans, W.P. Mitchell and Linwood T. Dorsey, told not only about the voucher system and other devices employed to discourage Negro voting, but also about brutal police raids on the offices of organizations that encouraged Negro registration. As the senators listened, the gravity that some of them had assumed for the benefit of the one or two photographers present seemed to deepen into a feeling more genuine, and several picked up the printed text of the two Alabamans' statements and began reading intently with expressions of shock on their faces. If these liberal senators had forgotten what they were really fighting for, they were reminded that morning. The news conference ended shortly after the Senate's noon bell rang, and they walked out on the Senate floor full of indignation, and as they came through the double doors, Richard Brevard Russell was speaking at his center aisle desk, as courteous and urbane as ever, and he was denying that Negroes were excluded from voting or jury service in the South, illustrating his point with homey anecdotes. "Mr. President, I well remember the first time I ever went into a federal court as an attorney. I think it was in the year 1920. It so happened that I was representing a man by the name of Poke Manders, who had been caught at a still where illicit whiskey was being made. A great deal of that kind of activity has occurred in my section of the country in times past. On the panel which tried him were two of our Negro citizens." And their indignation boiled over. As soon as Russell finished, Javits said, "Mr. President, I do not think it is fair to let the record stand as it is. I know, and every other senator knows, that there are Negroes who serve on juries in the South. We also know that there are Negroes who vote in the South. I invite the attention of senators to the facts on the merits, Mr. President. One fact is that in case after case after case, including cases in Georgia, the Supreme Court has had to void verdicts of juries in cases involving crimes as serious as murder because there was a systematic exclusion of Negroes from juries." Then Douglas was recognized. Russell had referred to the recent race riots in Chicago and Detroit, and Douglas admitted that such riots had occurred. "But I can say that in the city of Chicago, Negroes vote," he went on. "They are not compelled to ride on segregated cars. They are not segregated in the schools. They have access to the parks and other public facilities. In these respects and many others, their dignity is not offended. They are treated as human beings. He pointed a long arm at Russell, sitting among his massed Southerners in the center section. "We are not trying to cover up abuses," Douglas shouted. "We are trying to remedy them, and I only wish my good friends from the South would adopt a similar attitude, instead of trying to sprinkle rose water on what we know to be great abuses." And Johnson's long attempt to avoid outright antagonism on the Senate floor may also have exploded, because Russell was losing on the jury trial amendment, and because losing was something that, despite his urbanity, Russell could not bear. At one point during Douglas's outburst, the Illinois senator, still pointing across the floor at Russell, said that the senator from Georgia has evidently been counting noses and knows he is losing. And when Douglas said that, Russell jumped to his feet and, as William V. Shannon wrote, stood upon the Senate floor and tore the mask of civility from the face of the civil rights debate, and in the process also allowed the mask to fall from his own face, as it had fallen before on the rare occasions when he had been losing. The high patrician brow and the arched patrician nose were flushed with anger, and in his eyes, as he stared across the desks at Paul Douglas, was fury. "The senator from Illinois points his admonitory finger," Russell shouted. "He says, 'You gentlemen are too sensitive.' Then he proceeds against our social order." "Hypocrisy," Richard Brevard Russell shouted. "Sanctimony, holier than thou." Then, as Shannon reported, he defended segregation in all its aspects. "You failed in the North," Russell said. "Your method does not work. You have race riots. But you come down and say, 'We know better. We are going to force you to do things our way.' I say, keep your race riots in Chicago. Don't export them to Georgia." Suddenly, the scene among the four long arcs of desks was a scene unpleasantly reminiscent of Senate civil rights debates of previous years. Hoisting himself upright and holding on to his desk for support because in his emotion he had forgotten to pick up his crutches, Potter of Michigan shouted to the dais, "Mr. President, will the senator yield?" Russell had no choice because, by mentioning Detroit, he had referred to Potter's state, and if there was anything almost as sacred to Richard Russell as the untainted blood of a pure white race, it was the Senate rules. "I yield," he said grudgingly. "None of us from the North are proud of the fact that race riots took place," Potter began. "But Negro citizens in our state have every opportunity to vote." Russell interrupted him. "Oh, they vote in my state, too," he said. "They vote as freely in Georgia as they do in Michigan. I am becoming tired of hearing that kind of statement." Russell had no right to interrupt him, Potter said. The senator referred to Michigan. "Yes, I did," Russell admitted. "I should like to have him listen to my reply for a moment," Potter said. His reply was that despite the riots, great progress has been made in Michigan. Because there are tensions, we do not stick our heads in the sand. Russell's face was a very deep red now. "I am delighted to hear the senator say that progress is being made," he said. Then he said, "The system which the senator from Michigan wants to impose on Georgia brought about race riots in Michigan. If the senator from Michigan would simply not seek to invade our state to fasten the race riot-generating system upon us, we would appreciate it. Let him keep it in Michigan." All over the chamber, on both sides of the aisle, senators were on their feet shouting for the floor. At first, Russell refused to yield it, but one of the senators was Pat McNamara, also of Michigan. "Yes, I yield to the senator from Michigan," Russell said at last. "I mentioned his state." McNamara said Michigan needed no defense, that his state could handle its affairs without outside interference. "Then why does not the senator let us do the same?" Russell asked. There was applause from the Southern senators seated around him, but he had asked a question, and he was to receive an answer to it. McNamara, Doris Fleeson wrote, roared in the bull voice trained in 1,000 union meeting halls, "Because you've had 90 years and haven't done it." The galleries above burst into applause. Appalled ushers rushed to still it. The two senators stood there shouting at each other in their contrasting accents. "I do not know what all the smog is about," McNamara said. "I agree with the senator from Michigan that he doesn't know what it is all about," Russell said. The Southerners laughed. I agree that one of us does not know what it is all about, but I am not sure that I am the one, McNamara said. The galleries applauded. Russell's rhetoric escalated into the rhetoric of martyrdom. When Florida's Spessard Holland tried to change the subject, Russell said, "Here we have a senator who wants to take time out from being crucified." He didn't want any timeouts. For more than 3 hours he stood there, lashing out at the North, while the North lashed back. Almost as dramatic to the journalists as the shouts of the debaters was the demeanor of the majority leader. As Russell raged on, Shannon wrote, Lyndon Johnson slumped further and further down in his seat. Misery and nervous irritability distorted his features. Then, as the man standing at the desk immediately behind him continued to rage, Johnson turned his chair all the way around, either to look right up at Russell, or, as Doris Fleeson suggested, for another reason, so that his face would be concealed from the press gallery, so that the reporters could not judge his reaction to the damage being done to his plans. For 7 months he had managed to maintain a layer of civility between the liberals and the South, against long odds. But now, in 3 hours, as Mary McGrory wrote, the veneer of senatorial courtesy which has given a high gloss to weeks of debate had cracked wide open. The attempt to make the whole question a constitutional problem rather than a human one abruptly collided as Senator Russell shouted at the opposition. Contained in the angry exchanges that had rumbled back and forth just over Lyndon Johnson's head, moreover, almost lost in the general invective but picked up quite clearly by his keen ears, had been some particularly disturbing sentences. At one point, Douglas, taunting Russell because he didn't have the votes, had demanded that the ballot on the jury trial amendment come soon, and had made the demand not only of Russell but of him. I think the majority leader could do very well by scheduling the vote not later than Saturday, Douglas had said. I wonder if the majority leader would consider that as a possible proviso. And when Johnson had replied that he had not given any thought to the matter, Douglas had been insistent. How about Monday? How about voting on the O'Mahony Amendment on Monday? The civil rights forces, knowing they had the majority, were pressing for a vote, as they had pressed for a vote in past years. Russell, lashing back at McNamara, had suddenly said, apropos of nothing in his previous remarks, "So, Mr. President, we have tried to act like reasonable men. We have tried to act with restraint in the face of great provocation. But, Mr. President, we reserve the right to defend ourselves. As responsible men, we shall insist on our right to be heard fully on all amendments to the pending bill." And there had been another development, peripheral but also an ominous straw in the wind. With funds for the Small Business Administration due to run out on Wednesday, July 31st, the very next day, Johnson, attempting to avoid the closing of the agency, had requested a unanimous consent agreement to take up its appropriation bill, and then return immediately to the civil rights debate. His request, however, had not been granted. Wayne Morse had objected, and there had been other hands raised on the floor when the presiding officer had recognized Morse. Other senators were prepared to object. The Senate had not been able to take up urgent public business. That Tuesday afternoon the body had, as Fleeson wrote, suddenly reverted to type. It was beginning more and more to resemble Senates of the past, in which the position of the majority leader had not been an enviable one. Scott Lucas and Boob McFarland had been in the same position that Lyndon Johnson was very close to being in now, unable to muster either the votes to end a filibuster or the votes to pass the amendment that alone could persuade the South not to filibuster. He was coming closer and closer to losing control of the Senate, as Lucas had lost control, as McFarland had lost control just before becoming objects of ridicule. A column by Murray Kempton published that Tuesday showed how perilously close Lyndon Johnson was to the same fate that had befallen his two hapless predecessors. Johnson, Kempton wrote, was almost the prisoner of the South. And with the 20-year dominant coalition between Southern Democrats and Midwestern Republicans in ruins, Lyndon Johnson's cupboard is bare. The politicians who count in the Senate today are William F. Noland and Richard M. Nixon. And Lyndon Johnson is a state of things whose time is past. Kempton wrote about the desperation with which Lyndon Johnson wriggled for delay, and about the fact that his wriggling was hopeless. The Democrats wondered yesterday, with Johnson in the shadows, how they could meet Nixon's triumphant kind of calculation. There was a phrase in Kempton's column that the leader was not used to seeing written about himself. The phrase was, "Poor Lyndon Johnson." And the most hurtful aspect of the column by this bellwether of liberal opinion may have been its implications for Johnson's hope that he could use the civil rights fight to get closer to the Democratic Party's liberal wing. Kempton's column showed how very far he was from achieving that end. Late Tuesday afternoon, however, things began to improve. There had, during those last days in July, been two developments that Lyndon Johnson had hoped would get him some of the votes he needed, and they both began to come to fruition not long after he had dejectedly returned, at about 4 o'clock, to his office from those 3 hours of misery on the Senate floor. The first development could be called a lucky break, unless one believes that man in part makes his own luck, and that if he pushes against a wall long enough and hard enough, refusing to stop, a crack will eventually appear somewhere in the wall. And unless one believes also that the crack wouldn't have produced Senate votes for civil rights, had not Lyndon Johnson known, as apparently no one else knew, how to widen it. While Lyndon Johnson had been in Texas the previous weekend, the telephone calls from Reedy had told him that his attempt to woo leaders of organized labor like Reuther and Kerry and Meany with a jury trial amendment had apparently failed. That Sunday, however, a dissenting, if informal, even offhand remark had been made by a less important labor figure, Cyrus Tyree, Cy Anderson, the rough-spoken, incisive chief Washington lobbyist for the Railway Labor Association, a loose central committee representing 12 railroad unions or brotherhoods. The remark was made in the unlikely setting of the Glen Echo Amusement Park in Maryland, where Anderson had taken his children for a Sunday outing, and it was made in the course of a rambling, desultory conversation with another man, a casual Capitol Hill acquaintance of Anderson's, who had taken his children there too. But this casual acquaintance to whom Anderson made the remark, "Any labor guy who is against jury trials ought to have his head examined," happened to repeat it to George Reedy Monday morning. Reedy didn't consider it especially significant, but he quoted it in a memorandum he gave to Johnson sometime after Johnson arrived back on Capitol Hill on Monday afternoon. And Johnson acted on it. No one had thought of the railroad brotherhoods as potential allies in the civil rights fight, for a very obvious reason. For almost a century, they had been fighting against equal rights for black Americans. Ever since they had been formed, shortly after the Civil War, the brotherhoods had, in fact, been among the most rigid bastions of racial segregation in the entire labor movement. Most of them, including the four largest, the Brotherhood of Railroad Trainmen, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen and Enginemen, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, and the Order of Railway Conductors and Brakemen, had outright whites-only clauses in their constitutions which barred Negroes from membership. When, in 1955, some of the brotherhoods had sought affiliation with the AFL-CIO, they had employed subterfuges to evade the Federation's anti-discrimination requirement. The trainmen, for example, had amended its constitution, not to remove the whites-only clauses, but rather to say that these clauses would not apply in states in which they conflicted with state law. In 1957, fewer than 2,000 of the trainmen's 217,000 members, fewer than 1 out of 100, were not Caucasian. And some of the brotherhoods were even more rigidly racist than the trainmen. The Firemen's Brotherhood, which had never had a Negro member, was that year determinedly contesting a lawsuit brought by Negro firemen to force that brotherhood to admit them. Few unions seemed less likely to be active supporters of a civil rights bill. But Johnson saw why the brotherhoods might be turned into supporters. He understood what Cy Anderson had meant by his remark. The brotherhoods had suffered greatly from judges' use of criminal contempt proceedings without jury trials during the railroad labor wars of the 1880s and 1890s. And with the Taft-Hartley Act, which had revoked provisions of Norris LaGuardia, the specter of such proceedings hung over the brotherhoods again. He understood as well that, while the brotherhoods' once immense political power had been declining because of the decline of the railroads, in one area of the country that power was still substantial, the immense flat plains of the Midwest. The Midwest, across which ran the great transcontinental rail lines, the Union Pacific and the Central Pacific, and the Southern Pacific. The Midwest, which contained so many of the railroad's switchyards and stockyards and roundhouses, as well as the great hubs, Chicago, St. Louis, Topeka, from which lines ran out like spokes of a wheel. The Midwest, where so many small towns numbered railroad employees, well paid by the area's standards, among their leading and politically influential citizens. Where so many of the leading law firms were on retainer to the railroads. Where railroads and their unions had always been a particularly potent political force. Where the support of railroad brotherhoods was still a key factor in deciding which senators were sent to and kept in Washington. The Midwest, whose senators were Republicans, conservative Republicans, the conservative Republicans whom he had, despite months of effort, been unable to break off from Noland and Nixon. On Tuesday morning, Lyndon Johnson telephoned Cy Anderson and asked for support for the jury trial amendment from the 12 brotherhoods, including a formal statement he could use to counter Kerry's. With his eyes focused on organized labor as a source of support for a jury trial amendment, suddenly Johnson saw more. There was one union to whom the memory of the power of federal court injunctions was especially fresh and bitter, the United Mine Workers. It had been as recently as 1946 that Harry Truman had seized the coal mines, and a federal judge had enjoined the UMW from striking, had then held the UMW's glowering, bushy-eyebrowed John L. Lewis in contempt of court for refusing to obey the injunction, and had forced him to order his miners back to work by imposing a potentially ruinous fine on the union. The center of the UMW's power was West Virginia. It was a one-industry state, and the industry was coal. No fewer than 117,000 miners, every one of whom belonged to the UMW, lived there. And West Virginia's two senators were the Republican Chapman Revercombe and the Democratic liberal Matthew Neely, both of whom had refused, Revercombe loudly on the Senate floor, Neely through aides from his hospital bed, to support the jury trial amendment. The UMW's chief counsel, and a man Lewis trusted as much as he trusted anyone, was none other than Johnson's friend Welly Hopkins. It had been Hopkins who had dragged the raging Lewis back into his seat in the courtroom in 1946, before Lewis could compound the contempt offense. And then Hopkins, beside himself with anger, had shouted defiantly at the judge, "This day will live in infamy, sir." Now, on Tuesday morning, Johnson telephoned Welly and asked him for a formal statement of support from John L. Lewis. Anderson had to go through channels with 12 separate brotherhoods. Hopkins had to make only one telephone call. At 2:48 that same day, Tuesday, July 30th, while Johnson had been slumped down in his seat on the Senate floor listening to Richard Russell rant, John L. Lewis sent him a telegram. "The United Mine Workers," the telegram said, "have traditionally and do now support appropriate legislation looking to the full enjoyment by all citizens of all civil rights." And, the telegram said, "the UMW also supported the jury trial amendment. A wise, prudent, and proper amendment. The strong power of injunction has been in the past so often abused." Sometime after Johnson had returned to his office from the Senate floor about 4 o'clock, the telegram was shown to him. He returned to the floor. The time was about 5:40. Olin Johnston was droning on. Asking the South Carolinian to yield, Johnson read the telegram, maximizing the impact by implying that it was an unsolicited bolt from the blue. "John L. Lewis had never communicated with me directly or indirectly until 2:48 p.m. today, when he sent me the following telegram," he said.
End of Disc 41.